Thank you again for all coming today, braving the weather and being here. I thought maybe it was just going to be me doing a recording a podcast for the internet today. So I'm grateful to see some faces out there today. I'm also grateful for the privilege to be here in this church and to be up here and to share with you some insights that I may have, however imperfect they are. But such is the nature of all our insights and our creativity. When Willis asked me to talk today, I had recently just received a book by a well-known theologian by the name of Harvey Cox, and it's called The Future of Faith. I read anything that Harvey Cox puts out because he's a wonderful writer of insight that really kind of gets exactly kind of the way that I think about religion. He is an American Baptist, so at first you might think that's a little odd for someone who's a Unitarian to be inspired by someone of this tradition, but Harvey Cox is a classic theologian of the American Baptist tradition, and another American Baptist theologian that I can think of is Martin Luther King Jr. So people of this tradition have an open-mindedness about what religion is. An open-mindedness about what God is and about what the experience that we have as God. So for me, it's a perfect fit to read Harvey and to have the insights that he has. So one thing he tells in here is that the Italian writer Miguel Unamamo, in his short story, which is entitled Saint Manuel Bruno Martyr, a young man returns to his native village in Spain from the city because his mother is dying. In the presence of the priest, she tells her son, "Please pray for me." The son does not answer as he leaves the room. The priest walks with him, and he tells the priest, "I cannot pray for her because I don't believe in God." "That's nonsense," the priest tells him. "You don't have to believe in God to pray." That might sound contradictory, but that got me to thinking about what faith is, what belief is, and it got Harvey Cox to thinking about the same thing too. Why would the priest tell the son that you don't have to believe in God to pray? Does the priest understand that praying is an act of faith? And what is faith but a very primordial instinct that all of us possess, whether we believe in God or not? I've heard some people say here that they don't necessarily believe in God, but when something happens to a loved one, the first thing they think of is to pray for that loved one. As I was sitting up here at the beginning of the service, I was thinking to myself, "Please, God, let me do this correctly. So, don't let me mess up anything." So, it is a primordial instinct that each of us have to pray, whether we have faith, whether we have belief or not. Does belief come from faith? Or does faith come from belief? Faith to me is a more primordial, as I said, a more primordial instinct. Faith and belief are notions that are different in each respect. Belief seems to be more of an opinion, one that's used in everyday speech to express some uncertainty. Someone might say, "I believe that the weather today is going to be cloudy," or "I believe the weather is going to be snowy today," but there's a little uncertainty in their voice when they say belief. If I say I believe in such and such that is true, I may not be sure, but if I say I have faith that something is true, I'm expressing an existential feeling that I really believe, that I really think that something is true. Harvey Cox in his book proposes that there are three stages in the history of Christianity, and he's speaking of Christianity first and foremost here, so I have to extrapolate a little bit, and I hope you can too. First of all, he says that the history of Christianity started with the age of faith, and that was from the time of the death of Jesus until about the time of Constantine. That people that followed Jesus at that time were referred to as the people of the way. They were not referred to as people of beliefs, and there were no set beliefs by these people. What they were trying to do was emulate the life and the teachings of Jesus Christ, but they had no set beliefs as to who he was or what they were and what they were supposed to do in order to follow this man. The second age that Harvey Cox proposes is the age of belief, and that's when Constantine the emperor had this vision that putting the cross on his soldiers' shields would somehow ensure him a victory on the military battlefield. Constantine could be thought of as the first CEO of Christianity. This is when the hierarchies developed. This is when beliefs were codified, creeds were written. There were church councils. Bishops were appointed by the emperor. Councils were developed, and the emperor influenced how and what beliefs were going to be set in stone and made into creeds. And, interestingly enough, this is when heresies originated too, because if you didn't believe in the creed that the emperor and the official church had set apart, you were then branded a heretic. This age of belief lasted about 1,500 years, or probably until the late 20th century, when people began to rebel against these beliefs, these set about creeds, these codified beliefs. And now we're entering into what Harvey Cox calls the age of the spirit, when the emphasis is on spiritual experience, discipleship, and hope. I think Unitarians have been pushing for the age of the spirit for many years now, but the majority of those people in religion have not really been listening too well. But I think they are beginning to listen now. What is it like to have faith without belief? I'd say to that, welcome to this church. So, many mystics over the years have emphasized faith, a mystery, a being that is unknowable, that's transcendent. As I read to you from the Tao Te Ching, that mystery that holds the universe together was always seen as the unknowable, the unnameable. Meister Eckhart, which is a 12th century mystic in Germany, referred to God as nothing, or the not God, which some of you might know. I've been rather fond of reading that. I'm going to read to you a little passage from Meister Eckhart here. If I can find it. The naked God is without a name and is the denial of all names and has never been given a name and so remains a truly hidden God. How should you love God? Love God as God is a not God, a not mind, a not person, a not image, even more as God is a pure, clear one who is separate from all two-ness. You can imagine that Meister Eckhart in the 12th century was branded a heretic for these writings. More recently, there's a North American Buddhist nun by the name of Pema Chodron who discusses a similar idea in the move from when we discussed theism and non-theism. She writes the following. The difference between theism and non-theism is not whether one does or does not believe in God. It is an issue that applies to everyone, including both Buddhists and non-Buddhists. Theism is a deep-seated conviction that there's some hand to hold. If we just do the right things, someone will appreciate us and take care of us. It means thinking there's always going to be a babysitter available when we need one. We're all inclined to abdicate responsibilities and delegate our authority to someone, something outside ourselves. Non-theism is relaxing with the ambiguity and the uncertainty of the present moment without reaching for anything to protect ourselves. Non-theism is finally realizing that there's no babysitter that you can count on. You just get a good one, and then he or she is gone. Non-theism is realizing that it's not just babysitters that come and go. The whole of life is like that. This is the truth, and the truth is inconvenient. Theism is an addiction. Meister Eckhart then said, I pray to God to rid me of God. So what does it mean to pray to God to rid me of God? To me, that means to rid me of those old notions of God that don't mean anything anymore. For God is this transcendent expression that holds the universe together. I have a faith that God is nothing, and yet existence is everything. What is it like to have faith in a mystery and in something that's unknowable, that you can't really think about in a concrete way? The second title of my sermon today was How Not to Be One of Einstein's Snuffed Out Candles, and I'll read you a little brief quote from Einstein, who, though a scientist, recognized that there is no separation necessarily between science and religion, that those who think of science in a reasonable and logical manner, but those who think of religion can separate the two so that one does not necessarily be restricted by the other. That those people who are scientists can also think reasonably about the natural world, but can also think more of the mystery of the natural world and be comfortable with that. So here's a quote from Einstein. The most beautiful emotion we can experience is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion that stands at the cradle of all truths, art, and science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is good as dead, a snuffed-out candle. To sense that behind anything that can be experienced, there is something that our minds cannot grasp, whose beauty and sublimity reach us only indirectly, this is religiousness. In this sense, and in this sense only, I am a devoutly religious man. So Einstein was a man who didn't go to the synagogue every Friday night. But he's a man who considered himself devoutly religious because he understood that the mystery of the universe was something that he was in awe of, and that his candle was always lit. And he felt sorry for those people who could not see this mystery and whose candles were snuffed out. Finally, I'd like to close today with a meditation. This is a meditation that I learned from a Christian, a Catholic priest, a Franciscan priest by the name of Richard Rohr, who I've quoted before up here and I think really understands and is very comfortable with the notion of mystery. At this time, at this Christmas time of year, it's especially been said that we talk about the incarnation. The Christian churches talk about incarnation at Christmas because this is when the time that when God became present on earth in the person of Jesus Christ, according to the Christian churches. And this they refer to as the incarnation. But here in the UU Church, I think what we have is what I would call, and others have called, the radical incarnation. Radical meaning to the roots, back to the beginnings and the basics of all things, not radical in the sense that it's something outlandish and outrageous, but radical in the sense that it gets to the meaning and the root of existence and of the fundamental things that hold us together. Radical incarnation, I mean, is that God or some existence, some mystery, is present in all of us and in all things. This is the radical incarnation that I speak of, and the radical incarnation that Richard Rohr speaks of as well. So, one way to get to this feeling of radical incarnation, this feeling of recognizing that there is this mystery and this existence that is in all things. Richard Rohr has four steps that he tells everyone to go through. First, find an object. Sit in a quiet place and find an object and focus on that object. Focus sensorily only. Don't think, but just look at the object and just look with your eyes, or if the object has a smell to it, smell. But just look and don't think about what the object is. He says after a while you will initially get this feeling of calmness and peace by looking at this object. Second, don't make any judgments about the object. Refrain from any critiques or analysis. Don't think it's silly, it's stupid, or good, or bad. It just is. Be what it is, this object in its isness. Richard Rohr says that if you practice this long enough, you will begin to feel this joy about this object because you're not making any judgments about it at all. You feel this joy. Next, and he says this is difficult for men to do, enter into a dialogue with the object. You know, ask the object, what do you feel? What do you think I'm feeling? How are you doing today? And enter into this eternal, this dialogue with the object. And what this does is it gives the object respect. When you enter into a dialogue with the object, you begin to sense that this object has meaning, that it has a respect, a vitality, a life, a purpose, some kind of meaning. And then you start respecting the object for itself, in itself. And Richard Rohr says, if you do this, then the emotion that overcomes you is love, respect, and reverence. And if you can do all three of these things, then you start to enter into a feeling of love and respect for every object that's in this world and every person and everything. You see everything as part of this grand universe, as part of the mystery of the universe, not as a thing to be used and thrown away, or a person to be used and thrown away, or maybe an animal to be used and thrown away. But you start to see respect and love for every object. And in that way, so doing, you start to respect and see a worth and a purpose in your own life and all the things that you can do and accomplish. I left the other page down here, sorry. This is the beginning of a what Richard Rohr would say a non-dual consciousness. You begin to think past the duality that all of us Western thinkers are so stuck in thinking that things are good or bad or right or wrong, left or right, up or down. The non-dualness goes away, and this is what Richard Rohr says leads to the contemplative life. We accept everything non-judgmentally. Beliefs are no longer important, but faith becomes the most important thing. Faith in existence becomes real, and you become more present to the present. Like Einstein, I have faith in the mystery of existence, and I would count myself as devoutly religious. I don't believe in God, but I have faith in everything that is God. I have faith in the nothingness that is God. As Meister Eckhart said, love God as God is, a not God, a not mind, a not person, a not image. Let the mystery be.